traffic and the early Sunday morning and the rest of it to come. I'm going to talk to you about basically a framework for retirement savings, a way of thinking about the problem of making decisions about retirement savings. And part of the reason I'm doing this is that one of the things that I and my collaborators have worked on is the problem of, Allison, is the volume good? Or up to you. Okay. So part of the motivation for this is actually building tools for financial advisors to help clients make decisions about retirement savings. The retirement savings universe has sort of changed a lot over the last 10 years, especially with the growth of a bunch of guaranteed products that sort of blend annuities and investment accounts in complex ways. These aren't things that financial advisors have a lot of experience dealing with. Fundamentally, they are complex products, and managing them is complex. And sort of building tools so that the advice that financial advisors give their clients is actually well-founded is something that I and my collaborators got interested in doing. So that's the motivation for a lot of this work. So imagine that you're saving for retirement. You've got some nest egg, and you want to figure out what to do with it. And the traditional products you could invest in, I'm going to label as either a SWIP, a systematic withdrawal plan, or an annuity, which I'm going to use the acronym LPIA for a lifetime payout income annuity. And people are familiar with these things. They're basically the extreme choices you could make in terms of retirement savings. You can either keep all your money yourself and invest it in the market, consume from the proceeds or the capital, and hope that it lasts, or you could turn all your money over to an insurance company and basically pay me fixed income for life. There are pros and cons of both strategies, and it's sort of helpful to understand what they are. Of course, most people shouldn't do maintain everything themselves or give everything up to the insurance company. For most people, there's some advantage in having a mixed strategy that incorporates perhaps some form of annuity. It might be a company pension plan or something like that, along with some level of savings. And as we'll see, for many people, it's also a good idea to incorporate some form of guaranteed or variable annuity. So the problem with viewing this as an optimization problem is that there isn't really necessarily an optimal choice. There are actually trade-offs, and the trade-off I really want to focus on today was the one in the title of my talk. This is sustainability versus legacy. And in particular, trying to present information, trying to sort of choose the right risk measures to discuss with clients that allow them to see very clearly what the trade-offs are and allow them to try to make good decisions about those. So let's, just to focus on this, let's look at the pros and cons of those two different traditional retirement savings products. So for a systematic withdrawal plan, of course, it's a nice thing that it preserves liquidity. And that's a disadvantage of an annuity. Liquidity goes away. You give your money to the insurance company and it's gone. If 3 years from now you suddenly discover that you need cash or there's something that you need those resources for, they're not there anymore. On the pro side for the SWIP, it's a product that actually preserves some form of legacy. Assuming there's something still left in that investment account when you die, It leaves something behind for your kids or your heirs. That's, again, not typically true with an annuity. When you die, the money's gone. The SWIP is very often inflation protected. In other words, if you've invested in the market, then there's capital growth associated with that, and that basically helps you track inflation in some sense. It's actually rather difficult to buy immediate annuities that have a lot of inflation protection. Typical immediate annuity, the payments one is getting either erode with inflation, or you basically have to pick an inflation rate and assume that that's how it's going to work. Again, advantages for the SWIP: it preserves upside potential. If markets do well and everybody else is wealthy, you're participating in that because you're invested in the market. Not so much with an annuity. If everybody is doing well, you kind of might feel left out. On the other hand, there's risk associated with a traditional investment portfolio, certainly risk of investment losses. If the market does badly and you're heavily exposed to the market, that may have a serious impact on what you can do in retirement. That's one place where the annuity starts to shine, that there's downside protection. Your money keeps coming through regardless of what happens to the market. Moreover, with an annuity, you get enhanced returns. Part of the reason that when you die, the money's all gone is that the insurance company is using the funds. Essentially, it's using the funds of the people who have died early to give returns to the people who are living longer. And so in essence, you're getting excess returns. You're getting mortality credits because those people who don't need their money anymore are funding your retirement. And with the annuity, of course, the big selling point of the annuity is that there's no longevity risk. If you live a long time, that's not a problem. If you live a long time, the annuity keeps paying you, whereas if you live a long time with basically an investment account, the longer you live, the greater the chances are that you're actually going to exhaust the account and there won't be anything left to fund, basically to ensure that your retirement consumption is sustainable. So there are pros and cons both ways. And one does well as far as sustainability. So as far as sustainability, the fact that there's no longevity risk, decent returns, and downside protection means that an annuity basically wins as far as pure sustainability goes. Traditional puzzle of economics is why, when that's the case, so few people actually buy these things. On the other hand, there's no legacy at all, so if you have heirs, if you're worried about leaving something behind, then an annuity loses. So there. So this is a finance conference. I'm not assuming everybody here has an actuarial background, so let me remind you a little bit about the mortality credits, the enhanced returns that come with an annuity. This is data on annuity yields in Canada, so yields for someone who buys an annuity at age 65, and you see that for basically what's a fixed income investment, these are rather high. You're sort of in the 7-9% yield range, which is a pretty decent return on a fixed income investment. And this is basically because you're not just getting fixed income returns, you're getting fixed income returns grossed up because you're essentially getting paid by the people who die early and don't need the money. And of course, if you buy at age 75, the returns go up. The longer you wait to buy an annuity, the higher the return you're going to get. Because, of course, you're, compared to other people in the same age, you are, no mortality goes up, and so the benefits that accrue to the people who are still alive go up as well. So, you know, if that was a pretty decent return, a 10, 11, 12% return from fixed income is actually pretty good. And this is why annuities actually have relatively good returns compared to fixed income. Now, the trade-off I'm really interested in focusing on is sort of highlighted the following way. So I'm thinking about retirement planning as thinking about three different quantities that an individual would need to specify to formulate a reasonable retirement plan. They need to think about consumption. How much do they actually need to earn? How much do they actually need to spend in order to finance their retirement? Nobody can tell you what you need to spend. That's a decision that you as an individual need to make. Sustainability, how confident are you that you are actually going to be able to sustain that consumption? How confident are you that the funds are actually going to be there to fund the consumption that you need in retirement? That's kind of the sustainability axis for retirement planning. And the flip side of that is legacy or liquidity, if you don't want to think about heirs. In other words, is there going to be, so just thinking about it in terms of legacy, is there going to be something to leave behind to the kids when you aren't here anymore? Typically, sustainability and legacy conflict with each other. They compete. The more sustainable a portfolio, the more sustainable a plan is going to be, the less legacy is likely to be left behind, and we saw that with an annuity. Fully sustainable, no legacy whatsoever. On the other hand, investing in a market portfolio, the sustainability is not certain. I mean, you may run out of money. On the other hand, that is an option that does leave something behind for your heirs. So somehow, retirees, when they're making decisions about how they plan to set things up, they really need to think about those two issues, and they need to think of those two issues as comparing, as competing with each other. Basically, they need to answer the question of where they draw the line between their needs and their kids' needs. And that's a serious choice to make, and it's the kind of choice we want to use. We want to use our risk measures to try and understand. We want to help people confront that choice and think clearly about that trade-off. So basically, to do that, we need two appropriate risk measures. One, to evaluate the sustainability of a portfolio. We're going to call that RSQ for the retirement sustainability quotient. It's going to be a number between 0, 1, or a percentage or something that gives our level of confidence in how sustainable the portfolio is. And the other is going to be expected financial legacy. This is going to be a dollar figure, and it's going to measure essentially how much of our portfolio we think of as going to finance legacy. How, if we've got a nest egg of, I don't know, say $500,000, how do we split that between us and the kids? How do we split it 50-50? Are we thinking of that $500,000 taking $250,000 and saying, well, that's basically going to finance my retirement, and another $250,000, that's basically something that I hope to be able to leave, or what that eventually grows into is what I hope to be able to leave to the kids, or is 50-50 not a good split? Should I be a little more conservative about my own needs and maybe make it 300-200, or should I take on a little more risk on my about myself in order that I can be sure that I leave behind something more substantial for the kids? If that trade-off doesn't resonate with you, then this isn't the right approach to take, and maybe one of those extreme strategies is. I mean, if you don't have any kids, you don't care in the slightest what happens after you are no longer on this earth, then maybe you should just buy an annuity and go enjoy life and forget about the rest of it. If you're Bill Gates, and no matter what you do, you're never going to run out of money, then also, you know, this doesn't resonate with you. And again, you should forget about retirement planning. You don't need to do it. For most people, they don't find themselves in either of those situations, and this is exactly the kind of conversation they need to be having with a financial advisor. Basically, what we're talking about, once we've got these two risk measures, is now being able to show individuals some kind of efficient frontier between the two of them so that they can properly assess the trade-off, something like this. So what we've got here on this axis is RSQ. This is measuring the level of sustainability that we're hoping to target. On the other axis is EFL, the expected financial legacy, and the different curves correspond to different spending rates. So, some obvious things about this. If the higher the spending rate, the lower the sustainability gets and the lower the legacy gets. The more you spend, the more you're planning on spending, the less is left going to be left behind, and the riskier your portfolio gets in terms of sustainability. So one choice you need to make is what kind of spending rates are sustainable. Typically, for the parameters we use for this kind, to generate these numbers, we're talking about an individual age 62, and we're ending up with spending rates that have, so we haven't done anything where the sustainability drops below 75%, so we've got that kind of range here, and for those kinds of numbers, spending rates between about 4.8 and 5.8 seem to fit in here reasonably well. So then, once you pick the spending rate, you've decided which of these curves you're going to be sitting on, and now you see the trade-off. So if I've decided I'm going to spend at 5.5%, that 5.5% of my current nest egg can be used every year to fund my consumption in retirement. Now I have to decide how I'm going to allocate, how I'm going to set up the portfolio in terms of these asset classes to try and figure out what values of the risk measures I'm interested in having. So, for example, at this end of this curve, here I've got a relatively high, compared to these other things, I've got a relatively high financial legacy, but a lower sustainability. The sustainability there is about 80%. So here I am, I'm taking more risk on my own shoulders in order that I can leave a little more to the kids. Whereas as I move down here, I'm sort of increasing the sustainability of my portfolio. I am being more and more conservative about my own needs in retirement. But the consequence is that the portion of my initial portfolio that I expect to eventually go to fund my legacy keeps dropping as I go down. And it's sort of this is the framework that I'm thinking of for retirement planning. And basically my job today is to tell you exactly, much more precisely, what the risk measures I'm talking about are, the RSQ, what that risk measure means, what this measure, EFL, means, and then to talk a little bit about how one would generate the numbers that give rise to this kind of planning tool. So that's my job. So I kind of, this was the first, we're through my talk version one, in which I've basically given you a broad outline of what the problem is. The problem is to develop plots like this that allow people to plan. And now I'm going to go back and do it over again, but I'm going to be much more precise about what exactly these risk measures are, either the retirement sustainability quotient or the expected financial legacy. What the risk measures are that, in conversation with people who actually do this, how you find risk measures that really bring out the kinds of decisions people need to make, and then how you calculate them. So that's what I'm going to do for the rest of the talk. So before I do that, I want to expand the universe of products that I'm talking about. So far I've only talked about annuities and basically a traditional investment account. I said at the very beginning that one of the things that has changed in the retirement universe is that there now exist products that are sort of in between those, and these are actually products that I and my co-authors have done a fair amount of work on over the years. There are certainly products we want to include in this kind of planning in order to be, you don't want to just ignore them. If you do that, you're not really giving very good advice to clients. Why do these guaranteed products exist? Well, one reason is that companies have been divesting themselves from their traditional defined benefit pension plan. Fewer and fewer people out there actually have a traditional pension plan in which there's predictable income for life that they know, and they know what it's going to be early on in their career. And as a result, insurance companies and banks and various other groups have got into the business of offering clients products that kind of fill that gap, that fill the gap of a traditional defined benefit pension plan. I mean, there are all kinds of risks associated with retirement planning. That's what we've been talking about here, risks of running out of your money, longevity risk, how long is my retirement going to be, how long am I going to live, will my money last? These are all things that people who haven't worked in finance or insurance are not well equipped to make decisions about. And so having things that play the role of a defined benefit pension plan, or at least in some aspects, really does help individuals plan for retirement. And this is where financial innovation has taken place over the last decade or so in this area. So I'm going to talk about this. I'm not going to talk about a specific product in any way. I'm going to kind of talk about a generic product, which I'll call a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit. In the United States, these would be attached to variable annuities very often. These basically blend features of an annuity and a systematic withdrawal plan. And basically the way they work is they act like a systematic withdrawal plan, but one is paying fees to on top. But in any case, basically you can think about it as something that acts like a systematic withdrawal plan until the account actually is exhausted, until the account gets ruined, until you run out of money. And at that point with a systematic withdrawal plan, you'd say, I shouldn't have behaved this way. But with a guaranteed product, you don't have to do that. With one of these guaranteed products, what happens at that point is that the insurance company starts funding the withdrawals you would normally have made if there had been money left. So at that point, okay, legacy goes away. There's going to be nothing left for the heirs at that point. You have used up your legacy. But retirement income actually persists. In essence, what happens is that at the ruin time, it converts to being a life annuity so that income then continues forever or until you walk away from the account. But after ruin, you probably wouldn't do that. These have been incredibly popular in the U.S., Japan, the U.K., and elsewhere. They entered Canada in 2006 and have been quite popular here as well. And so, for example, during the downturn, they worked exactly as expected. People's wealth went down, but that didn't mean they had to stop withdrawing because the insurance company was basically backing this up. So, and just to give you an idea of the popularity, here's a rather old slide, 2007 sales in the U.S. of annuities. The annuity business was about $220 billion in the U.S. in 2007. And the traditional annuities, which in this side are listed as single premium immediate annuities, but this is what I mean by the LPIA, the traditional annuity, they account for a really tiny chunk of that market, or tiny in relative terms. Whereas the kind of product I'm talking about, the kind of guaranteed product that has this has this income guarantee built into it, or at least could have this kind of income guarantee built into it, what in the United States is called a variable annuity, accounted for a rather large chunk of the market, almost 70% of the market. So that's what I mean by it being very popular. Annuities, traditional annuities, are not very popular. These variable annuities, much, much, much more so. Yep. So I don't think things are all that different at the current time, but I don't have numbers to put up. So these numbers come out of industry reports. Notice that the actual assets that are sitting inside the guaranteed product or versus the assets that are sitting inside the investment account, they're actually exactly the same assets. One's investing in the market, one's investing in bonds, whatever. So in other words, the assets that are supporting, that are producing the income that sits within the product, these are the same. So this really isn't thinking about whether you want one of these guaranteed products or a traditional withdrawal plan is not a question at all about asset allocation. And this is something that we emphasize to financial advisors. Financial advisors are used to thinking about asset allocation. They're not so used to thinking about the trade-offs between these kinds of things. So choosing between them isn't really a question of asset allocation. We call it product allocation. It's really a question of deciding which product is going to be the envelope in which you put your assets. And it's making decisions about product allocation that I'm really interested in producing methods of giving advice to people. So now we've got an investment universe consisting of these guaranteed products with systematic withdrawal plans or annuities, and I'm going to throw in, of course, the fact that there may be pre-existing pension income. In Canada, there would be the Canada Pension Plan. In the U.S., there would be Social Security. There might be, for someone like me who works at a university, there might be a defined benefit pension plan. So this isn't taking place in isolation. People have other assets, and I'm going to use P for pension to represent the exogenous pension that needs to be taken into account, but isn't actually part of the decision about how to allocate. I can't allocate it. I can just be aware of it as I'm allocating the rest of the nest egg. Now the point is that each component here has a different characteristics of sustainability and legacy. The annuity, fully sustainable, no legacy whatsoever. The guaranteed product, because of the guarantee, is also fully sustainable. That income is going to persist for as long as you want it or as long as you're alive. But it has partial legacy. I mean, if the account ruins, your income persists, but your kids don't get anything at the end. The SWIP has the highest legacy. There aren't as many fees associated with it, so what's left behind is likely to be bigger if there's anything there, but it has the lowest sustainability because, of course, once if it gets ruined, then that income stream isn't there for you anymore. So what we don't want to do is so here would be a bad risk measure. A risk measure that is just the probability that there are always resources to fund consumption, that would be a rather bad risk measure. That would be basically saying there are two things that can happen. Either it works or it doesn't work. There's nothing in between, and the probability of it working, that's certainly a risk measure, but it's not a very good one. It's much more... What you really want to do is you want to have some risk measure that does so, that something like 1 minus expected loss given default, if we were talking about the credit world. What we want to have something that is sensitive to the importance of, so I'm not going to do exactly that, but I am going to want to do something that captures that idea, but something in which the importance of a particular income stream is taken into account when you are looking at the probability of sustainability. So what we do is we break, worked in this kind of context was to break the different income streams up in, break the total income stream up into pieces, look at the probability of each piece being sustainable, so look at the probability of each piece being able to produce the income that we're expecting from it, and then weight those probabilities by the importance of that particular stream in the retirement portfolio as a whole. So to put numbers down, or to put variables down here, let's let P be the rate that the pension, that's a bad choice, isn't it? Anyway, P be the rate that the pension is paid, A be the rate that's going to be the annuity is being paid at, G be the rate that the guaranteed product is going to be paid at, C is going to be consumption. So whatever's left over is what the systematic withdrawal plan has to provide. So the and there should be a minus P there as well. Sorry. So I need to fix this slide up. And so W is C minus A minus G minus P. Now that's the rate of income that is supposed to be supplied by the SWIP. So then we compute the probability that the pension is sustainable, probability that the annuity is sustainable, probability that the guaranteed product is sustainable. Now those are all one, so not hard to compute. And the one that we actually have to do some work to compute is to compute the probability that the systematic withdrawal plan is going to be sustainable. And then we weight each of those factors by the its importance in the income stream. So for example, if the pension, the annuity, and the guaranteed product by themselves were enough to sustain consumption, then you wouldn't be withdrawing money from the SWIP at all. You'd actually just be accumulating money in the SWIP, basically, to leave to your kids. The probability of the SWIP being sustainable would be 1, so if all of those probabilities are 1, then RSQ is going to be 100%. So that's the way you think about it. And if this if you actually do need to rely on income from the SWIP so that this probability is going to be less than 1, then, and in that case, W is going to be greater than or equal to 0, you really are going to be making withdrawals for it, then RSQ slips below 1, and, you know, the more you rely on the SWIP and the more you're exposed to the possibility that the SWIP might get ruined, the lower RSQ is going to go. To actually calculate things, we need some dynamics. What I'm interested, a piece of that expression that I actually need to calculate is this probability. And so that probability is going to be the probability that at the time of death, there is the probability of sustainability is going to be the probability that at the time of death there's still money left in the account. So if you let WT be the account value, and you let zeta be the time you die, you want to calculate that probability. The SWIP dynamics, again, I'm just going to do this in a very simple model. Do this in a simple model where we basically have a GBM reflecting the asset growth in the asset returns in the SWIP. So we have some growth rate and volatility for and that's overall, so that's taking into account whatever the asset allocation is in the SWIP and rebalancing within the SWIP, et cetera. So if you have some GBM model there, and then you're withdrawing, that remember W is a withdrawal rate, you have a stochastic equation for the dynamics of the SWIP account there. You, of course, need to know something about the lifetime, so the person's age and health is going to factor into this. You'll use an actuarial model for the lifetime. And then you can write down a PDE to solve for that quantity. This is fairly standard. We produce the PDE is by looking for an appropriate martingale. We want to calculate the probability at 0. We're going to write that as some function of 0 and the initial SWIP account value. To produce a martingale, you look at this thing, the probability that you don't get ruined, given the information available to time t, it's fairly clear that that's only going to depend on what the current wealth is and what the time is. Certainly the time is going to come into it, because that affects how old the person is. So, so you get an expression like this for what that conditional probability is. Conditional probabilities, of course, like that, are going to be martingales. The one aspect of this that isn't, that is sort of a bit more actuarial, and people who haven't thought about actuarial issues may need to notice in this slide, is that there's a jump at the time of the lifetime. At the time of the lifetime, so suddenly we die, and now we know exactly what this probability is going to be. It's either going to be 1 or 0, depending on whether there actually was money left or not. So this martingale up here that I've written down is going to have a jump at the time of death. The way we get a PDE is we subtract the compensated jump from this martingale. If we subtract the compensated jump, that gives us something that doesn't have a jump anymore, and so we'll actually be a nice martingale when stopped at the ruin time. And from that, we can read off the PDE. So if you subtract the compensated jump, basically what you're doing, the jumps cancel each other out, and what you're doing is adding in the jump compensator. And so we get that this expression is going to be a martingale stopped at the ruin time. And now, just plugging into Ito's lemma, you get the PDE that thing has to solve, and then you go away and solve it numerically. And as a result, you can calculate the survival probability for the SWIP, the sustainability probability for the SWIP, and out of that comes our risk measure. So now we've got the first risk measure. What about the second risk measure? Much the same story, except I have to be a bit more precise about how I define it. So I'll spend most of my time talking about what I'm actually going to mean by this risk measure. We define expected financial legacy as the amount of current financial wealth that is ultimately going to go to fund retirement. In making these decisions, it really complicates things if you think about what the check is going to be that your kids get from the estate when you die, what the actual legacy is going to be at some point in the future. And what complicates thinking about this is you don't know when you're going to die, you don't know when that's going to be, and sort of comparing money at different times clouds the decision-making process. I mean, if you live a very long time, then a high legacy isn't quite as impressive as if you pass on that large legacy after a very short time. And so looking at what is actually received is complicated. Basically, when you make comparisons, you're comparing apples and oranges. It's much more effective to think about looking at present value of everything, to look at what the value of the legacy is in present value terms rather than in actual terms down in the future. So in other words, we'd really like to think of this as saying, okay, I've got a certain nest egg. How much of that is going to me? How much of that is going to the kids in average terms? How much do I expect to fund me, and how much do I expect to fund the kids? So it's got to be denominated in current dollars. I've somehow got to take the present value of things, but I've got to take the present value of things that are growing stochastically because they depend on investment returns. So to think about how you do that, let's think about a couple of examples. So the first one is really straightforward. Say we've got a client whose approach to the decision making is to say, okay, I'm going to make a clean split right now. I'm going to split my wealth into two pieces, A and B. I'm going to use A to buy an annuity. That's going to be what I live on. And I'm going to plunk B into an investment account, and it can grow over time or do whatever it wants, but that's, I'm not going to touch that. That's going to be the legacy. Basically, I set aside the investment money for the kids. Now, I make the split. Now, what is my financial legacy going to be? Well, if I take this approach of denominating everything in current dollars, financial legacy is just that money that you set aside. Not complicated by what the returns are going to be, that will depend on how it's invested, but I have taken my nest egg, I've actually split it into two pieces, and I've set aside this for the kids, and you know, you can report that. That's how you did the weighting between those two things. That's the situation, if you adopt that strategy, that's the situation in which this is as clear as it possibly can be. So keep that in mind. What I want to do is to think about doing exactly that kind of very clean split between us and the kids, but in situations where it's not so obvious what exactly the value should be for the financial legacy. So a more typical example, suppose we were going to go completely with a systematic withdrawal plan. So I'm going to take all my nest egg, I'm going to plunk it into this market portfolio and manage it and rebalance it. And I'm going to use that market portfolio to fund both my consumption and the kids are going to get whatever's left in the end. How am I going to assess right now what I think of, on average, as being the kids' portion of that? Well, obviously, I don't know what that's going to be exactly. I don't know what the ultimate number is going to be because, you know, the longer I live, the more of that nest egg is going to fund me and the less is going to fund the kids. I don't know what investment returns are going to be. I don't know what my lifetime is. So I can't actually say that at time zero. I can't observe the fraction at time zero, what the fraction that's going to eventually go to fund the kids is. But when I die, my estate could go back and actually figure out what that actual number would be, the fraction of, I mean, everything's invested in the same place, it's all rebalanced. Retroactively, you could go back and figure out, in the end, it turned out that half the money got used for Tom and half the money got used for Tom's kids. We can't observe that number at time zero, but what we can do is use the expected value of that number as our risk measure. And this really clarifies decision making. If you can think of saying, well, I don't know exactly how much it's going to be, but I think that I'm managing this portfolio and consumption and the rest of it in such a way that it, on average, it's a 50-50 split between us and the kids. Well, that's something that people can feel comfortable about understanding and comfortable about understanding the consequences of their investment decisions. So it really focuses information on the piece we must decide about, what we anticipate the allocation to the kids being, rather than on things we can't control, like future investment returns. So that's our risk measure. The expected portion of current nest egg that ultimately will be going to the kids. So how do you put this together? Well, again, we've got different income streams from the different asset classes. We can imagine computing how much of each stream there's going to be in terms of expected financial legacy, and then just lumping them together to form the EFL for the entire retirement portfolio. And just as before, there are some for the pension, there's nothing left. For the annuity, there's nothing left. So those are both zero. They drop out. And we've got these terms here. This last term, so this is the legacy left from the guaranteed product. This is the legacy left from the withdrawal plan. And I'm going to throw in another term here, EFL ruin, which I'm going to tell you about at the very end. So let me, which is coming up pretty quickly, so let me do this. So then we can go through the same kind of math we went through for the RSQ. We figure out how to solve all of these things by writing down a PDE. In this case, where does the PDE come from? It comes from the following consideration. If you've got the this is all relative to some asset class. If you take the asset without withdrawals and compare it to the same asset class with withdrawals, then what happens is you can figure out the proportion of the portfolio that's actually going to go to fund that's going to be left over at time theta. It's basically the ratio between those two things, what the portfolio would have been with withdrawals as a fraction of what it would have been if there hadn't been any withdrawals at all. It's just an elementary thing to go back and check that this amount invested at time zero is what grows into that amount. So my risk measure, in mathematical terms, is exactly the expected value of x theta over s theta. And now you plug in dynamics. So we've got, again, I'm going to take a simple case. We've got basic dynamics for the portfolio without withdrawals. Same dynamics here, except I put a withdrawal term in. You let ZT be the ratio of those at time T. You plug it in and you find out that the Z is actually a bounded variation thing. It's actually going down. The dynamics for Z are that dZt is minus G over ST. So what happens is that Z starts at 1. It doesn't start at 1. It starts at the initial value of the portfolio, and then it goes down from there. The longer I live, the less of my initial nest egg is going to fund the legacy. And basically, I want to calculate that expectation. Just as before, you can write down a suitable martingale, throw in a compensator, and get a PDE for exactly what that has to give you. And that gives you these first two terms there. The very last thing I have to do is explain the last piece. That's the ruin term. And this basically comes from the possibility of a ruin before death. That what happens if the systematic withdrawal plan runs out of money and it can't actually fund the consumption that I require in retirement? Now, if you think in practical terms, what happens at that point is that you stop relying solely on financial resources, and you turn to other possibilities to fund retirement. For example, you can turn to non-financial assets like the house. Maybe you take out a reverse mortgage to supply the missing piece of consumption. Or maybe the grandkids start helping grandma live in a retirement home at that point. Maybe the heirs are actually going to have to contribute in order to make sure that their parents or their grandparents can keep going. In either cases, this is basically a negative legacy. So we were talking about financial legacy. If you start eating the home, that you can think of that as a negative legacy, or heirs contributing, that's a negative legacy. And since financial assets aren't going to be directly involved, we'll model this as the hedging cost that a financial firm would actually demand for insuring consumption streams against the ruin of a base portfolio. This is actually something that's been studied before. We've written papers on it. We've called the ruin contingent life annuity. This, because the hedging cost is a risk-neutral thing, but one can go through the same kind of dynamics. Basically, what one is calculating here is the cost of hedging, so it's a risk-neutral valuation. Here is the rate at which the income stream has to be replaced. Here is the event that the ruin actually occurs before death, and here is the present value of the money that would have to be paid between time R, the ruin time, and the lifetime. So this is the present value. This is the present value of the money that would have to be made up in risk-neutral terms. And one can do exactly the same process as before, write down a suitable martingale, plug in, get a suitable PDE, and again, one can calculate the last piece. Just to end up, what do you do now that you've actually calculated these risk measures, now that you've calculated them? You can present the efficient frontier, and moreover, you can optimize. For example, for a fixed value of RSQ, you can optimize the product allocation between all of these asset classes that would actually maximize the financial legacy for a given value of RSQ. So for example, as we go down these things, you would see, I mean, here, now I've thrown this in, this is the product allocation here, it's 9% guaranteed, 91% 91% market, that is the, of these things, that's the highest allocation to the market portfolio and produces the highest financial legacy. And as we go down this, what you're going to see is that the market piece is going down and you start throwing in maybe an annuity piece and more guaranteed piece. So now you've got a little sliver of annuity and more allocation to the guaranteed, a little more guarantee, a lot more annuity, and as we go down, you can see that this, I'll just go back and forth over these a few times, you can see how the that the allocation moves in exactly the way you would expect, but that you can actually quantify these various things. Final slide. This is work that we've actually, not in this simple model, but in a more realistic setting. This is actually stuff that we have implemented in a software tool called OPAD, Optimal Product Allocation and Depletion Module, which is exactly the kind of thing that an insurance company or a bank could go out and use to allow its financial advisors to make good decisions about retirement. And I'm a little over, but thank you for your attention. Speaking as Matt Davison, let me thank the speaker again and ask if there are any questions. Yes. Yep. They're related. The RSQ is about the